Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anthony Bubalo, and I'm the Deputy Director and the Research Director at the Lowy Institute for International Policy. Welcome to this evening's event at the Lowy Institute at the NGV, part of our regular series down here in Melbourne. It's fantastic to be back here again at the NGV on such a lovely day as well. I've got to remind myself that I've got to ask these guys questions rather than staring distractedly outside at the lovely gardens. It's great to be here, as I said, and great to be here with a couple of Lowy Institute colleagues to talk about, a less happy topic, but an interesting one nevertheless. So I have with me this evening Lydia Khalil, who is a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute, and Roger Shanahan, who is a research fellow at the Institute. And we're here, of course, to talk about the day after, looking at the foreign fighter problem in Iraq and Syria, and in fact, a lot more broadly than that. Tonight's talk is very much focused on, we'll start with a focus on a research paper that Lydia and Roger wrote for the Institute a couple of months ago that was released and still on our website and worth a look. But we'll go beyond that paper's focus on particularly the foreign fighter problem in Iraq and Syria and look at the issue more broadly. And we'll talk for about 30, 40 minutes and then we'll have time for Q&A towards the end. So please join me in welcoming Roger and Lydia.
Thanks, Michael.
So we are a little bit of a turning point when we think about the foreign fighter problem. For 4 or 5 years now, we've been concerned about individuals with extremist backgrounds going to Iraq and Syria, or even individuals without extremist backgrounds going to Iraq and Syria and being radicalized, joining Islamic State, but other jihadist groups like Islamic State. But it's fair to say now that the focus is starting to shift from people who are going to Iraq and Syria to people that are coming out, to those that have gone to Iraq and Syria to fight with these groups, who've gone, who've become more technically proficient, more lethally proficient as a result of their exposure to fighting in Iraq and Syria, who have built networks and connections with other jihadists, and you're talking about something like over 50 different nationalities who are represented amongst the kind of foreign fighter population in Syria and Iraq, who have become lethally connected with these groups and who now are starting and already have started to kind of dribble out of Iraq and Syria and may do so, particularly as the military campaign on Islamic State potentially draws to a close. There is now a major military campaign focused on Mosul, Iraq's second largest city, one of Islamic State's main stronghold in Iraq, one of its major two cities of its self-declared caliphate, the other being Raqqa in Syria, where, too, there is also being military pressure placed. And there's a reasonable chance that, sometime in the next 6 months, maybe shorter, maybe longer, these two major cities will fall and Islamic State's self-declared capital will cease to exist. And we'll talk a bit about some of that as well. But we then reach a point where that caliphate that Islamic State founded and from which it called other young men and women from around the Muslim world to come and to join and to fight with them will cease to exist. So what happens to those foreign fighters when they start, particularly those that are not from the Middle East, from the Arab world, when they start to flow back out and go back to their home countries and flow back out into the international system? And some of the questions that we'll be posing to our experts tonight. I wanted to start with you, Lydia, first to talk about the foreign fighter problem, really to kind of help us define it, to give us a basis for our conversation tonight. So when we talk about the kind of foreign fighter phenomenon, what are we talking about?
So at its most basic, a foreign fighter is someone who is of a different nationality who goes to a conflict zone in another area. So it's an Australian national going to fight in Syria, for example, or a European going to fight in Bosnia in the 1990s. So the particular problem we're focused on right now is jihadist foreign fighters. We've seen this conflict in Syria and Iraq go from a localized conflict to a regional one and now to a more globalized one. And the jihadist aspect of that has taken on a huge part of it with the establishment of the Islamic State a couple of years ago. It's a very complicated threat picture, and we talk a little bit about it in our paper that you can find online on the website. But mostly we've seen a huge cohort of foreign fighters going into Iraq and Syria, something estimated at about 30,000, although exact numbers are very, very difficult to come by. But that's kind of the rough statistic that we've been going for. That's much larger than we've seen in other jihadist conflicts in the past, so much larger than those that went to Afghanistan that brought about al-Qaeda. It's much larger than the cohort that went to Bosnia, and much larger than any others that have gone for. So we're dealing with a very significant number of people who have gone to fight, who have either remained there, or who have filtered out, and some who may have died in place. So this is going to be a long-term problem, no matter what the Islamic State looks like now, and no matter how it ends, and it will end, but some remnant of that is going to remain. And it's important to note, I think, when we talk about foreign fighters, that so much of the focus has been on the Islamic State, but actually there's a lot of other players in town. So al-Qaeda still has a huge presence within that conflict, and other jihadist groups do as well. So we have to be careful not to just solely focus on Islamic State, even though they're kind of the where most of the attention has gone. So that's where we're at in terms of when we talk about foreign fighters in Iraq and Syria.
Roger, this is not a new problem, as Lydia mentioned. I mean, we have seen previous generations of foreign fighters, you know, including foreign jihadist fighters, most notably those that came out of Afghanistan during the jihad fought against the Soviet Union there and the years after that, which of course, you know, was out of that milieu that al-Qaeda was formed. What makes this particular cohort in Syria and Iraq more dangerous, more worrisome than that group?
Yeah, I suppose there's several reasons for that. I mean, Lydia has highlighted the first one's the sheer quantum of the problem. We're talking a much larger cohort of people than we've seen before over a more compressed period of time. The kind of skill sets that they would have gained in Syria and Iraq, the intensity of the conflict is much greater, certainly than was seen in Afghanistan, and was on the same level as perhaps some during Bosnia and Kosovo. So it's the quantum, it's the intensity, and it's the skills transfer. As you know, the conflict in Afghanistan was 30 years ago. The kind of contemporary techniques, the kind of people who are involved in them, a better degree of technical proficiency, a better degree of technical education, and a better understanding of things like operational security, of how to network, of how to use technology. So I think not only is the quantum the problem, but it's also the kind of skill sets that these people are going to acquire before they come back. And I suppose the other issue that we need to touch on, because it's very common for us here in Australia and in the West in general, that when we talk about foreign fighters, we equate them with Australian foreign fighters or Western or European foreign fighters. But the reality is that the majority, about two-thirds of the foreign fighters, are actually from the region. So Arabs by and large, Turks, also people from former Soviet Union. That's the kind of concentration of people and the kind of networks that they're going to form and the kind of places they may gravitate to afterwards. It's going to be much more likely to be concentrated in the region than in, say, Western Europe or, you know, down here in Australia. That doesn't mean that they're any less of a threat, because most people would realise in a globalised society or globalised international order, people travel regularly, and Australians travel as much, if not more, than anybody else. So all but one of the Australian victims of terrorism over the last 15 years have all been overseas. So when Australia and other Western governments look at the counterterrorism problem, they've got to look at it in a globalised fashion, not just what are Australians doing, not just what are Australians going to be doing if and when they come back. You've got to have a look at the whole picture. So I think for those reasons, this generation of foreign fighters that are coming into and out of Syria and Iraq is different to what we've seen before.
It's also fair to say, isn't it, too, that you know, even though the numbers are large, if you're talking about 30,000, 40,000 foreign fighters, it's only going to take a small proportion of those who want to continue to continue the fight elsewhere outside of Iraq and Syria. And we're already seeing some Islamic State people shift to Libya. That it's still going to cause us problems, won't it?
Certainly, and this is, I suppose, the other point. It's you've seen we're talking 30,000 plus people who have travelled overseas to conduct jihad, but there's been lots of people who have tried but have been stopped. So there's still willing volunteers, not only in the West but in our region, in Indonesia, in southern Philippines. But they haven't been able to acquire these skills. They're an immature degree of planning, and you've only seen in Indonesia some attacks that are being carried out that are being quite amateurish in their execution, very aspirational in their planning, but you only need one or two people to professionalise how they conduct these activities based on a wealth of experience picked up in years of fighting in Syria and Iraq to feed back into these pre-existing groups. And I think those onesies and twosies are going to have an effect, a potential effect, that's going to be much greater than just their individual or collective identity, because they're going to be able to pass on those skill sets and these operational security understanding to a new generation of people back from areas that they've come from or perhaps that they've ended up in.
Lydia,
To point out, in addition to all of the experience that Roger's pointed to, that this particular cohort is particularly dangerous because they've disproportionately been involved in the most extreme acts of brutality that ISIS has committed in Iraq and Syria in that battle space. And they've been disproportionately involved in the propaganda efforts as well. So those two particular things added on to all of the fighting experience and the practical experience and the networks that Roger has spoken about will make it much more likely that if they do link up with others outside of the conflict zones as they kind of dissipate out, that they will be that much more dangerous than what we've seen previously.
So as I mentioned at the outset, the focus now in terms of at least Islamic State's future is, at least in the form of the of its self-declared caliphate, is very much the kind of the battle for Mosul, which has begun. Tell us a bit about that and its significance in terms of what it means for Islamic State, what it means for the foreign fighter problem going forward. Lydia?
Well, Mosul is particularly significant. So as you mentioned, Anthony, in the beginning, it's Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq. Those are the two strongholds that ISIS has. It's a major city, over 1 million people. They've governed it. It's been they've held on to it militarily. So its loss would be particularly significant for the Islamic State. The way that the battle is going now, it seems to be going in the way of the Iraqi forces. They've controlled the eastern part of the city. They've flanked it around the south, the north, and coming toward the west. But Mosul poses some particular problems for the Iraqi government forces and all of those hoping that they succeed. The first one is that the majority of the fighting forces are so Iraqi government forces with coalition support. However, we still see a presence of both Kurdish militias and Shia paramilitary organizations involved in the fighting. That's particularly problematic because it is that same issue of sectarianism in Iraq that we have seen over the past decade that actually gave rise to al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was the predecessor of ISIS. So those forces are still fighting. There is no resolution in terms of what will happen post Mosul falls into the Iraqi government's hands. The momentum of the gains that the Iraqi government and the Iraqi forces have made has slowed down significantly. The battle plan has been for them to suggest that the civilians stay in place and the fighting continue, because frankly, the Iraqi government forces cannot deal with the refugee flows coming out. But what that's done is pose significant civilian casualty, which plays right into the hands of ISIS recruitment, the Islamic State recruitment, and their narrative and their setup kind of going forward of what they might do a year or so time. So if we were kind of to look into a crystal ball and see, well, what's going to happen with Mosul? Predictions are that it will fall, but will it fall easily? Perhaps not. indications now are that the momentum is slowing. It's going to get very messy. The same sectarian conflicts that have underlaid that city and that conflict remain. And so far, there's been no resolution to those. So essentially, even if you do flush out ISIS, you're starting from exactly square one again with no solution forward in terms of addressing those fundamental concerns about sectarianism and violence and power sharing.
And this is quite critical, Lydia, isn't it? I mean, in the sense that you could, in effect, defeat Islamic State in Mosul, and a bit like, you know, the defeat of al-Qaeda in Iraq in the mid-2000s, they'll disappear for a while, and because you haven't solved the fundamental problem, they'll reemerge in a different form.
That's exactly right, yeah. That's exactly the threat that's posed from this fight. So it's actually one very small part of a very long battle that we were going to have with both the Islamic State, with al-Qaeda in Iraq, with Jabhat al-Nusra, with all of these jihadist groups there. The fundamental problems and political concerns and sectarian concerns that gave their rise still have not been resolved at all. Yeah. And so until that happens, we're not going to see a resolution to this issue.
And Roger, as Mosul falls, as the battle for Mosul continues, when it eventually falls, what does it mean now for that kind of cohort of foreign fighters that are with Islamic State? Are we already starting to see them try and leave? You know, what are the different options open to you know, different individuals? It's something we dealt with in the paper.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I suppose what gets most popular play is that foreign fighters who've been in Syria and Iraq, once the end comes, or when they understand the end is nigh, that they'll leave and they'll return to their countries of origin. But the reality is there's not going to be any one way in which people posture themselves after they leave Syria and Iraq. You know, first of all, there are people dying in place, and there'll be more foreign fighters dying in place. The last kind of figures that have been given out is around, out of that 30,000 odd that have been there, somewhere between 18 to 20,000 remain alive. That was before the battle for Mosul, so that number will have been reduced. There'll be other people, and probably we need to understand that organisation like Islamic State is largely, its command structure is largely Iraqi. So the key decision makers tend to be, not exclusively, but tend to be Iraqi. And so a number of them who are veterans of the surge in 2006 in Iraq have maintained friendly relations with their tribes in Iraq. And as Lydia pointed out, if the governance if the Iraqi government doesn't address the fundamental problems with poor governance in the country, they'll still have an area that is willing to protect them for a period of time. So some of the senior Iraqi leadership, certainly in Islamic State, you think would stay put in Iraq and remain underground for as long as they can, remembering that during 2006 and the surge, al-Qaeda in Iraq got down to just a couple of hundred people. So, and then they built up from there. So some of these people will believe that this is just the surge part two. We're temporarily defeated, but we'll just lay low. We'll wait for the poor governance to allow us to attract ourselves. We might modify our message somewhat, learn from the mistakes that we did before, but then we'll be postured to go ahead. Other people will leave Syria and Iraq and go to the next theatre of jihad. So we've already had Islamic State say in the past that if you can't make it here, then seek out other areas such as Libya, perhaps Yemen. Most likely they will go through Turkey. The reality is the areas that Islamic State control in Syria or still have control are in the north of the country. It's a 900-kilometre long border with Turkey. Even if they wanted to seal it off completely, they couldn't. There's 16 international airports in Turkey. We've seen with the people movement in 2015 into Europe, sea routes, sea people smuggling routes and land people smuggling routes have been proven already. So there's a willing cohort of people smugglers who can get you onto another destination. There's a land route up through Turkey north and then northeast into the Caucasus. There's quite a number of fighters from the Caucasus, so there's pre-existing networks there. virtually impossible to stop. And they'll just, those people go on to another area to fight. A much smaller cohort, you would think, would try and return back to their countries of origin, either A, because they're sick of the fight and they just want to get home, and they've seen too much. And part of those will want to come home and continue the fight at home. Virtually impossible to understand people's motivations for coming back to their countries of origin, so you would have to treat them as having intent, whoever wishes to come back. And there will also be other people who will go to other areas, third countries, and try and operate out of there. And as we said in the paper, these are going to be quite tricky because if you're a European who's turns up in Southeast Asia, for instance, you may not be under the same kind of surveillance, perhaps, when you're entering public spaces as you would if you're a local. So those are, you know, some of the four or five versions of how these foreign fighters are going to end up. So I think it'd be a mistake if we all think foreign fighter or Australian foreign fighter, what do we do when they come back? We have to address that, obviously, and I think the government is and continues to do quite a good job in doing that. But we also have to pay at least, if not more, attention to where they go after. So where are they going to go to? What kind of countries are they going to operate in? What kind of relations do we have with those countries? Can we pass information on to those countries? If Australians end up, Australian foreign fighters end up in those countries, what kind of information can we pass to those governments? It's going to be a really tricky situation in the future, and it's going to be quite a confusing one because people are going to, foreign fighters in Syria and Iraq are going to continue on their path in a variety of ways.
Lydia, I mean, what shift would you expect in terms of Islamic State's ideological agenda? You know, we saw initially they were very focused on the caliphate, telling people to come, the fight in Iraq. Will we see a kind of a commensurate shift in terms of their external ambitions, talking more about jihad outside of Iraq and Syria?
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of the $100,000 question. As soon as the Islamic State started to lose territory and come back militarily, we saw a strong correlation with that happening and their focus on international attacks. So, but the big question is, will it continue to do so? Will they have the resources to do so? Yeah. That's a big question. I think they still have the ambition to do so. We've seen that they've had the ability to kind of walk and chew gum at the same time. So while they're fighting very heavily in the local battlefield, they've also been conducting external operations as they did last year when they were facing battles in Syria and some of the international attacks that we saw in Europe, the Russian airliner over Egypt and those kind of things. So I think that it's safe to assume that the Islamic State in its kind of form that it has been over the past year as this kind of quasi-government or governance structure will be gone. But will it continue to be a terrorist organization? Yes, absolutely. How far-reaching will it be? It's still, that's the kind of question. It will depend on how heavy its losses are. And we've been focused on the battles in terms of, say, Mosul or Raqqa or all those kind of territorial assets that it has, but it still controls oil fields and other financial gaining resources for them. So that also is going to significantly impact that. And I think that they've been proven to be an organization that's very nimble, can think on its feet, can adapt extremely quickly, and so we should expect the same thing of them. I mean, you just take a look at their most recent history, but also the past history, as Roger alluded to earlier about their former iteration of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. From that to where they are now to what they could be is very different, very fluid, and they've proven that they can kind of continue to do so. The big question also, too, is how will they relate to other jihadist organizations? How will they relate to Al-Qaeda? How will they relate to other smaller groups? How will they relate to the affiliates of theirs and Al-Qaeda's in Libya and Yemen? Will their losses within Iraq and Syria spur a competition, a kind of jihadist Cold War, so to speak, in those other areas? And will we see the fallout of that? So these are all the big questions that we have to be taking a look at as it evolves over the next year.
Roger, you know, the scenario we talked about, you know, Islamic State failing in Iraq and Syria and foreign fighters leaving, in some respects kind of fleeing, has already started to play out, and most famously, most recently, in the case of Neil Prakash. Talk us through that and some of the dilemmas that, that his arrest in Turkey will now pose for the Australian government.
Yeah, I mean, it's a it's an interesting one about how people deal with foreign fighters when they're detained. And a country like Australia, with its tranche of foreign fighter legislation, which has given the Australian government some quite powerful legal tools to apply against people, is not necessarily replicated. Well, in fact, it's not replicated in all of the countries that will be subject to foreign fighter returnees. And this is one of the problems that we'll face. We're fortunate, as in the Australian government, in the case of Neil Prakash, we have an extradition treaty.
So maybe just give some background on Neil and who he was. And...
Sure. Neil Prakash was a Melbourne boy of Cambodian and Fijian Indian parentage, a convert to Islam, a low-level gang member in Australia, came into contact with radical Islam through the Alpha Khan Centre here in Melbourne, and then found himself in Syria sometime in 2013 or 2014. He first probably gained prominence in Australia because he appeared in an Islamic State video, which is entitled "Come to the Jihad," and it was a straight recruitment video featuring three British English speaking jihadis and three Australian English speaking jihadis, and it was very much trying to entice English speaking Muslims to come to Syria to continue the jihad. The whole video goes for about 13 minutes. He only appears very briefly. He doesn't have a speaking part. He's probably the only one out of the six that doesn't speak. But he's there plainly to see. He made his own video in 2015 where he basically, it was a piece to camera, and it was telling people about his story, about how he was an outsider in Australia but found purpose in Islam, found a brotherhood amongst fellow Muslims, and he was empowered because they were bringing forth the Islamic government in Syria and then entreating other people to come and follow him. And so he's trying to make people who might feel in the same way isolated that he did. He's done this journey, and you can do that journey too. So that's his public persona, and he's also in social media been in contact with people in Australia, including Noomin al-Haider, and people in other countries, encouraging them to do attacks against government targets in their home countries if they're not able to make their way to Syria. So his notoriety and his interest to security authorities was because of the fact that he was a native English speaker. He was very active in proselytising and encouraging youth to come, and he also represented with his mixed ethnic background and as a convert to Islam as a kind of mirror image of some of the people that he was trying to either bring over to Syria or to encourage to do attacks. So he's very believable to an audience on social media. He has now ended up in Turkey. The details are coming out through media. We don't know exactly how he was. He ended up in Turkey, whether he was interdicted on his way to somewhere else, whether he had an intent to try and come back to Australia. All of that stuff is unknown, but we'll find out in due course, I'm sure. But he's been detained by the Turkish authorities. So this is an opportunity for the Australian government to extradite Neil Prakash back to Australia. And one of the problems that Australia and lots of other Western countries face in trying to prosecute foreign fighters is the evidentiary threshold. What's admissible in court so that you can prosecute these people before a jury? one of the best ways of doing that is to prove it through social media. So you get people like Neil Prakash, whose whole notoriety is appearing on Islamic State recruitment videos and telling people about his Islamic State personal journey. And you would think out of all the foreign fighters that are going to come back to Australia, Neil Prakash would be possibly the easiest one to prosecute because he's been stupid enough to put himself all over social media with Islamic State logos, saying he's a member of Islamic State and encouraging people to join. So he will be an interesting test case for us. There's no foreign fighter has been prosecuted in Australia yet. One is going to trial in Melbourne, I believe. But there's been a number of people who, as facilitators, people who have attempted to go to Syria and Iraq, people who have sent funds to Syria and Iraq, and at the moment they've all the prosecutions have been successful. So the legislation that has come into play has been quite effective. But he will also be, when we talk about what his importance is, I think you also have to understand he'll be important in niche areas. He'll be important in putting together little pieces of information about how Islamic State social media strategy and campaign was waged, which is probably an area that this Syrian Iraq foreign fighter era has been particularly strong about, and something that we don't know that much about why it is so attractive to people in terms of their identity. But he'll know a lot about that because he was active within it. But because of his mixed parentage, he's and his lack of religious knowledge and his background, he's not a senior leader. He's not an operational commander. He won't have the jewels, the crown jewels of information about future strategic intent. He's not in. He doesn't travel in. He didn't travel in those kind of circles. But it'll be of interest to see how he got out of Iraq and Syria, because once you need to know all these little tactical pieces of information, what kind of documentation he had, how he got that documentation, what the standard of that documentation was, whatever electronic devices he has on him will yield a range of other information. So he is going to be of interest at a relatively low level, but he's also going to be of significant interest when he comes back to Australia as the as a high-profile foreign fighter who will probably be quite easy to prosecute.
Lydia, we're not just entering a new era when it comes to the foreign fighter problem, we're also entering a new era of American politics with the incoming Trump administration. How do you, I mean, how, from what we know, and I understand it's very early days and it's still very speculative, but how do you think a future Trump administration will deal with this problem, deal with the question of Syria and Iraq? What do you think their instincts are going to be in terms of how they respond?
It's a good question. I think Trump's election obviously is a huge wild card, right? He was a candidate who was heavy on the rhetoric, very slight on the policy details. So we don't know exactly where he's moving on certain fronts. He did say some inflammatory things, some things that people thought were extreme in the space of how he wants to deal with the issue of terrorism and the Middle East. At one point, he advocated torture of terrorist suspects. At one point, he advocated the killing of their relatives in order to get to terrorist suspects. At one point, he advocated kind of carpet bombing Iraq and Syria as a solution. On another hand, he said that he would try to remove the United States from its interests and commitments to the Middle East. So some of his statements have been all over the place. And, oh, of course, the how can we forget the ban and registry of Muslims entering the United States. So many people would say, well, those were campaign promises or rhetoric and we shouldn't hold him to it. He will moderate as he comes into office, or his advisors will moderate him as he comes to office. But there's a very strong push for presidential candidates and presidents to actually fulfill their campaign promises. We've actually seen that historically. So we should expect that he will at least try to fulfill some of those things. He will be stymied by the Constitution, for one, on some of them, and other opposition in different quarters in the United States. But I think we when someone says they're going to do something, particularly a presidential candidate, we should hold them to the to their word and expect that they will at least try to do so. A lot of it is going to depend, I think, on who he has around him and who he appoints to what position. So right now it's kind of a a chess game of who's going to fill what slot, and that's kind of the gossip going around. But we're seeing that it seems like Flynn will be his national security advisor.
This is Michael Flynn, who is the former the head of the DIA under the Obama administration, and was, from what we understand, removed from his position.
That's right, yeah. So he was someone who was very heavily involved in the Iraq and Afghan conflicts. He basically ran the targeting of jihadists and terrorists within Iraq and in Syria as well. So he's someone who has a heavy intelligence knowledge, but from all accounts, he's a very tactical guy, doesn't have the big strategic outlook that you would expect of a national security advisor. So if he will be, in fact, the pick for national security advisor, this is someone who does at least have experience in that area. The defense secretary, another important position that would impact Trump's policy on this, it could potentially be Mattis, General Mattis from the Marine Corps. It was reported that after he met with him, he came away very impressed, and Mattis kind of convinced him that torture wasn't the way, that he could get more done with cigarettes and a beer in front of an interrogation subject. So it seems that perhaps he could be swayed that way. In terms of Homeland Security picks, Secretary of State, it's still very much up in the air. But again, by accounts, Trump is not a person who sweats the details. He's been conciliatory toward Russia, so that's a very interesting dynamic to see how that's going to play out in terms of the Syrian conflict. He might put out some concessions to Russia, cut a deal with them to have Assad stay in power, which is looking much more likely, even if he wasn't conciliatory toward the Russians. So it's all of these kind of big question marks that's going forward. But already, we've seen a lot of nervousness, not just in America, but I think around the world, about his rhetoric toward Muslim Americans, Muslims around the world. What that will do in terms of the jihadist recruitment push is a big question also that remains to be seen. I mean, they could definitely use that in their rhetoric and propaganda to bring more people to their cause when they say, well, see, look, we're right all along. You know, the West doesn't want you. You're better off under us and our caliphate and through our cause. So I think that the long and short of it is that the Trump as president, as president-elect and a future president, assuming nothing happens with the recount, is going to be a very significant consequence, but it still remains a big wild card.
Well, it's kind of saying something that we seem to be more confident about what foreign fighters are going to do than we are about what the future U.S. president will do.
I know.
So it's now time to turn to the audience for questions. Please raise your hand if you have a question for our panel. Wait for the microphone and tell us who you are before you ask a question. Down the front here.
Hi, my name's Daniel. Question for you. Just in relation to the talk that you had around the jihadist Cold War,
mm-hmm.
wondering if you could expand on that concept of what presumably occurs, what the consequences might be on that.
So within the Iraq and Syria landscape, the Islamic State is not the only actor, as we've discussed. Al-Qaeda branches have been also major actors within that conflict. And who's been ascendant has kind of waxed and waned. The Al-Qaeda in Iraq and in Syria, by all accounts, has done a better job within the conflict zone of embedding itself with the indigenous populations, has not used the extreme brutality that the Islamic State has used, has been a much more methodical, kind of quieter political approach to establishing their footprint in that area. So that's why I say, number one, whatever does happen to the Islamic State, the jihadist issue is not going to go away. So there's that. So Al-Qaeda's presence still remains, even though it hasn't really been the focus in the media and indeed among many discussions there. So there's that aspect of it. And within that kind of jihadist landscape, there is competition about who is going to be on top ascendant. I mean, the split is that brought about the Islamic State to begin with was that split within Al-Qaeda itself. It was a branch of Al-Qaeda in Iraq that kind of split off from mainland Al-Qaeda and established itself as the Islamic State. So that dynamic is going to continue. And I think the Islamic State, as it pulls back from its territory and its governance kind of concerns from the losses that it has, it's going to still want to show its relevance around the world, not just in that theater, but around the world. And I think one of the ways that it can do that is by putting these spectacular, externally focused terrorist attacks out there. And that's going to show how they're still relevant, perhaps even ascendant, as it goes forward. And so what is that going to, how is that going to push al-Qaeda? Are they going to remain this kind of quietest movement still being methodical in the Iraq and Syria conflict zone? Or will they seek to kind of respond in the international stage as well? So I think that's the dynamic that I'm talking about. So that competition between those jihadist groups remains very real, and it can be potentially and unfortunately, a cause for more violence going forward, even as the Islamic State diminishes.
Louisa Fitzgerald from the Lowy Institute. My question is for you, Roger. You mentioned earlier that you thought that the Australian government had been doing a relatively good job with foreign fighters who are Australian nationals returning to our shores. What have they done, and where do you think the gaps are that they're not meeting? What do you think they should be doing?
Well, it's not... It's in two parts. It's not, the legislation is in a number of tranches, so it doesn't just deal with Australian foreign fighters who are returning, but it's also dealing with people who are preparing or assisting in preparing acts of terrorism, or supporting foreign fighters, be it financial support, being facilitation of people movement. I think probably the previous legislation that some of the earlier people have been charged and found guilty on, so Sukaraya in Brisbane and Hamdi al-Qudsi in Sydney, was part of the old foreign fighter legislation, and I think it's a maximum of 10 years imprisonment. The new tranche of legislation, I think, ups that to 25 years, and it depends when the act was committed. So I think what it did was... increase the punishments, broaden the scope of who could be, not broaden the scope, but make it much more easily understood as to who could be prosecuted under these acts. And it's also updated the list of prescribed terrorist organisations, so groups that you are accused of supporting. And it was done, I think, in a very methodical manner. I think it was done in quite a public manner, and because it was done in five tranches, it was the system wasn't overloaded, neither the political system nor the social system nor the law enforcement system was overloaded. But I do expert witness in some of these trials, and the last one that was the week before last, a foreign fighter funder, the police are very, they say that their task has been made significantly easier in terms of gaining prosecutions by the latest tranches of legislation. It would have been quite difficult if the legislation hadn't been brought up to date. The difficulty, as always, with, as I alluded to before, is the evidentiary basis. You know, the security and law enforcement authorities have a pretty good idea of who is over there. The issue is, can you prove it when they come back? But I think time is on the side of the authorities, because as the cities are taken back, as more is known about them, evidence starts to come to the surface. You can put pressure on people who might appear as witnesses. And we've seen just recently a couple of foreign fighters who had gone and returned under Hamdi al-Qudsi. So they've been back in Australia for 2 and 3 years. They've only now been charged because the police have now been able to set an evidentiary trial, and they've got precedents of people who supported them have now been prosecuted and found guilty. And so I think the public should be, not be concerned that foreign fighters who have returned aren't immediately charged, because that's not going to be possible in all cases. But the law enforcement organisations will try and slowly build a case, and they'll eventually get to them. It might be 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now, but it's not going to be, this is one subject that won't be put to the side, I think.
My name is Joe. Questions about social media. You made a brief reference to it in terms of recruiting and publicity, but it's a worldwide thing, and so somebody can go from anywhere, set up a base anywhere, broadcast to the world anywhere, in terms of coordination, planning, educating, financing, the whole bit. What's happening in that area?
Lydia, do you want to take that?
What's happening in what, sorry?
Social media.
I mean, a person can go from Iraq and set up in Colombia and run an operation in Sydney.
Sure, I'll take a quick stab at that. I think with the social media landscape, I think that the jihadists have used that to great effect, and there's been certain advances on their front, most obviously with propaganda and connecting and communicating, as you alluded to, but also law enforcement authorities have made also some significant advances as well, and how they have been using and tracking people on social media to find out where they are, their locations, what they're up to. I think Prakash was tracked through his social media profile to where he, to where he's gotten detained now. So there's gains on both sides. The difficulty, though, from the law enforcement perspective, is that a lot of the new technology that these violent groups are using in the social media space and the communication space kind of fall within this, like, black hole. So they're all encrypted technologies. They've been using things like Telegram and other anonymous type of technologies where it's much more difficult to track them. We've seen the debate over the use of iPhones, for examples, and backdoors to get evidence off of people's phones for that. So that there's been some gains on both sides. And it's, again, this balancing act about how use it. It's a bit of a cat and mouse game, isn't it? So as soon as the jihadists find a way to kind of use it to their advantage, the authorities jump in, they find a way to circumvent around it. So I think we're just going to continue to see this kind of circular thing regarding social media and technology. And again, going back to this issue of unless these kind of fundamental issues are not resolved, we're still going to see this action going. And then the social media and technology is just going to be part of, again, that dynamic.
Roger, did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I mean, the social media aspect is you could do a whole presentation on that. It's fascinating insofar as what motivates somebody to leave Australia and go thousands of kilometres because of their religious identity to kill other people, essentially. And they can gain that identity through social media. It's something, the immediacy of it is something that's highly disturbing. It's something that we don't really have a good handle on. In the past, if you had left your country of origin or you had some connection with that country, you would find out what happened, you know, later, weeks later, days later, through the telephone, through reading newspapers, through word of mouth. Now you find out about it nearly instantaneously. But not only do you find out about it, you might not find out about the facts. You'll find out about the facts chopped up into a particular narrative that fits a particular argument. And then you adopt that. The difficulty is how you counter that. If you've seen the kind of jihadist social media online empowerment videos, there is no way under any law that a Western country could try and counter that with, you know, pictures of dead jihadis, which would be like with like. So the unfortunate reality about the question that you raise is it's fascinating. It's all about identity transfer. We don't know that much about it. And so it makes it very difficult to counter. But as Lydia said, one of the advantages of people being active in social media is it can be used as a targeting tool. So that's the one kind of comparative advantage law enforcement agencies can get. But in terms of identity transfer, it's a really powerful tool that I think is only going to get more powerful in the future.
One of the ironic positives as well, I think, about social media is that it will draw people into this kind of ecosystem, this violent kind of jihadist ecosystem, but many times many of them only remain active on social media. So a lot of them who are in that space, and there's a lot of them, don't go off and actually commit the physical violence. So it's a bit like advocacy on Facebook or political action on Facebook. It's just kind of clicking jihadist type of thing. So that's the less troublesome aspect. I mean, it is worrisome, but the less violently troublesome aspect of it. But then, as Roger said, it can very easily carry you into that violent physical world of it.
My name's Lauren. You talked about prosecution and conviction of foreign fighters and people on terrorism charges, but there seems to be a lot of gaps when it comes to prisons in Jordan, in the UK, in Australia, around de-radicalisation. I know there are only a couple of programs in Australia and, you know, the success, you know, is pretty mixed about what you can do in terms of de-radicalisation and in preventing further spread of radicalisation in prisons with vulnerable people.
Well, I'll just say quickly around that, just kind of going back to Prakash, to me he seems like the kind of the perfect illustration of a lot of the difficulties and dynamics with foreign fighters that we highlighted in the paper. I mean, he's someone who is detained in Turkey, who has their, as a country and intelligence and military force, has their own interests at play within the conflict. Multiple jurisdictions want to get a hold of him. and figure out what type of intelligence that he has. And of course, Australia has a huge stake in bringing him back. But having said that, there's a big debate over the pros and cons of actually having him back here and having him being put in the prison population. So where will they hold him? Is it going to be this kind of new supermax prison where he's isolated away? As you mentioned, we've seen real issues with radicalization within the prison population. So there's that whole debate about it. There's the debate about the degree of cooperation of third countries when they capture a citizen of your own country. So if we take a look at the issue with Turkey, by having Prakash, they have kind of a trump card, so to speak. They have a leverage over us in that. So they have their own interests at play. Well, what are they? Kind of given the political situation in Turkey, they can say, well, we won't give him back to you or drag out the extradition process and use him as leverage, for example, to have Australia pressured into saying the Gulen movement is a terrorist organization. So there are these kind of difficulties as well. And so we have to decide how much we want to push to actually bring someone back into our soil, how much we're going to cooperate, and how this one individual not just fits into the dynamic between, say, Australia and Turkey, but also all of these other jurisdictions that want a piece of him as well, in addition to the radicalization issue.
Trump card is not really a phrase we can use anymore, is it?
Yeah, should be
Roger,
careful about that.
You wanted to add to that?
Yeah, just briefly, one of the problems, and you pointed out the what do you do with people motivated that way that have created this identity that motivates them to kind of go travel far and to do terrible things. Again, I don't want to keep on pointing out the difficulties, but it's a difficult research area and probably the best one that's been done recently, and it's only because it's kind of cutting edge, there's not that much research depth on it, but the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation in the UK put one out about motivations for people and how you approach them from a de-radicalisation perspective. And part of the problems, which they admit, is that people lie about their motivation. So how do you start a de-radicalisation program when people know the last thing you want to admit is perhaps your real reason for going, or I just got a peripheral interest, I got sucked into it, and I was only on the periphery. That's not a real start point for de-radicalisation because they haven't been forthcoming with why they went there in the first place. So it is a difficult issue that's been poorly researched because there's not that many people to research on, and B, they don't necessarily tell the truth.
I suppose there's also a question of whether they know themselves why they went. I mean, in the sense of personal motivations and how they justified it themselves, but what were the real reasons they went and how they got caught up in it, that make this a very, very fraught process. Right?
Oh, they're extremely difficult. And how do you tick off on somebody that says, right, you've been de-radicalised, tick, go on, my job here is finished.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about what you're predicting with support for Al-Qaeda now, given the disputes between Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and Al-Qaeda had said, well, wait, don't establish the caliphate yet. Al-Qaeda could say, well, look, you were too hasty, so perhaps more support for Al-Qaeda from some of these people?
Yeah, I mean, that's that's a good question, one that people are poring over at the moment. My view is that the end point that they both want to achieve is the same. The difference is the speed with which you do it, and more importantly, who's in charge of the show as you go along. There's some talk currently that there are some internal disputes amongst Jabhat Fatah al-Sham, so the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, that perhaps they've been too conciliatory of collecting other groups, and they're not all as purely Salafist as they are, and perhaps we might need to have break away again and be Al-Qaeda in Syria. But when you look at the public messaging from Islamic State and Jabhat al-Nusra and Jabhat Fatah al-Sham, so the Al-Qaeda affiliates, Islamic State has always been quite forthright in condemning the Al-Qaeda affiliates as competitors. The Al-Qaeda affiliates have been less into the condemnation of Islamic State. And I think for a variety of reasons. One, they lost a number of fighters once to Islamic State because it was bigger, better, paid more per month, particularly after the fall of Mosul. So Al-Qaeda thinks more strategically, so they're probably half a view that if they trip up, then we can collect some of the people from Islamic State and they can come back into the fold because all they're guilty of is following somebody who had the wrong direction and trying to do it too quickly. But we're all travelling on the same called the Islamic Current. We're all in the same river. We're just travelling on the current, might be at one side of the river or the other side of the river. And, you know, Zawahiri has also been on record as saying that he thinks Southeast Asia is also ripe for jihad. So they don't have, they have not shelved their international aspirations. They've just allowed Islamic State to take the lead. And I think understanding that their model was unsustainable and eventually people would come around to them. So I think they have aspirations to probably a non-hostile takeover of elements of Islamic State, particularly Syrian elements of Islamic State, once Raqqa and Mosul fall. But they're going to have their own problem now because in Syria, they're locked into Idlib, more or less. And as the Syrian government takes over townships and Aleppo, the place they're letting people go to is Idlib. So they want to concentrate all the bad guys in Idlib, nominate Idlib as Al-Qaeda, a proscribed terrorist organisation has taken over this city, and Idlib will be the place where the Syrian government, with the Russians and whoever else they can cobble together, then targets it. So I think Al-Qaeda still has regional and international aspirations, but at a much slower pace than Islamic State did. But once they concentrate in Idlib, I think they're going to have to be forced to be more active internationally with more spectacular attacks to exact a cost on people for destroying them in Idlib. And that's what I would kind of postulate in the months ahead.
Is this on? Yes. My name's Jeff. I'm interested if the Australian counter-terrorism community, if you like, has a one view as to the level of threat that returning jihadists might cause the Australian community. I mean, I've heard all sorts of things from they might be, you know, disillusioned and not very effective. They might be disillusioned and be able to help with de-radicalisation, or they might have come back with a great deal of expertise and be able to be extremely effective against Australia, especially if they cannot be prosecuted and contained for quite some time. Is there a view?
Well, I think like any discipline, there's a multitude of views on this issue. So you won't have kind of the one line of either the Australian kind of counterterrorism community or the Western counterterrorism community. There are differences in it, just there are differences in any discipline. But that issue that you alluded to of some coming back disillusioned or some coming back ready to fight is something that we did take a look at in our paper. And one of the things that we concluded was is that there is no one model for a foreign fighter returning and what their threat level is going to be. There's actually very different ones, and it's in highly individual and highly idiosyncratic. So it really depends on which foreign fighters, what background they have, what their experience has been, what their motivations will be going forward. Roger spoke a lot earlier in the lecture about kind of the different pathways that these foreign fighters can go to, and they can go through those, all those different pathways. So I think the challenge is for the international and the Australian counterterrorism community is to pinpoint which pathway that that individual would go on and to come up with a nuanced and nimble policy response to that. So recognizing that it's not all going to go one way. So having mechanisms and policies in place to deal with this kind of multitude of threats coming from the various foreign fighters funneling back through.
Ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, we're going to have to bring it to a close there. It's been a great hour chatting with the colleagues about a really important topic and a really multidimensional one, as we've seen, and unfortunately, a problem that we're going to have to deal with in coming years, and that will pop up in all sorts of ways that we haven't really thought of. But please join me in thanking Roger and Lydia.